how you get a thread to run is once you've created a thread object, then you call the method start on it. And what happens then behind the scenes, and a thread object's created, all the, it's added to the thread table and so on. And then at some stage, the method run is called on that thread. And at that point, your thread is executing, and you put in the code that you want the thread to actually do. And we had a few examples of threads doing various things. Okay. Ah, go away. Okay. Where we'll mainly end up using thread stuff is in changing sequential servers to concurrent servers. In a sequential server, what you're doing is you're waiting for a connection to come in. When a connection comes into a server, it will then handle that message in some way and do some dialogue with the client. And the problem with the sequential mechanism is that while it's handling one particular connection to a client, it's not able to do anything else. And so anyone else who tries to connect at that same time will just get blocked out. So a typical way of handling that is to, every time you get a new message, is to create a new thread and handle the message within that thread. And the loop itself just goes around to see if it can get another new connection with new messages on it. And there's a thread lifecycle, which starts off that when a thread starts running, it can be moved to a non-runnable state, or it can move from that to a runnable state, and threads can move between these three states depending on things like if it's trying to read from a device that's not ready, it gets blocked. If the operating thread engine wants to run a different thread, then it will swap the current thread out. And that causes problems with shared memory issues, that whenever there's something that's shared between multiple threads, then you can get incorrect data occurring. So a typical way within Java to handle multiple threads is to use the keyword synchronized. And once a method is synchronized, it means that only that one method can run at a time, that no other method belonging to that same thread, a different thread cannot interrupt that method to stuff things up. So the simplest way of doing things is normally that you put the keyword synchronized in front. That synchronizes for the whole execution of a method. If you think that's too coarse, you can synchronize just on an object, in which case you can just synchronize on small blocks of code, say even one line if you want. And you can use that to fix up various things, like the bank account example that we were looking at. If you put the word synchronized in front of a couple of the methods, then they start behaving okay. 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 All right. We talked about those things. Let notify, read or write as. Okay. There are other problems that can occur with multi-threaded systems besides simultaneous access to shared data, and that is things like deadlocks. And deadlocks are basically, when these occur, your system just stops. It just comes to a halt for some reason or another. And the simplest example of something like that occurring is if you get two processes or two threads, one of which is trying to send data, process one trying to send data to process two trying to send data to process one. In order for process two to read, to get received data from that pipe, it would have to do a read. Simultaneously, also P1 would have to do a read if it wants to get data off P2. And also, P1 would have to write down pipe one, P2 would have to write data down pipe two. And you need to get those the right way around. If you get them the wrong way around, then nothing happens. So if you say something like, the first process is going to initially write something down this pipe and then read something from the other one, while process two is also going to read from pipe one and then write to pipe two, then you end up with a deadlock, because both processes are trying to do a read and neither of those can succeed until the other one has done a write, but the writes can't occur because they're both blocked on the reads. So you've got a situation there where it just comes to a stop because of a deadlock. And there was a common example, you still see this occasionally, there used to be a road traffic rule called give way to the right. This was before you had stop signs and give way signs, and it was, if you were coming up to a junction, there was a car on your right hand side, you had to stop. And it didn't matter, you could be on a three-lane highway, it could be on a pokey little road, that you had to stop anyway. And you'd see things like down Dandenong Road and things, the brakes would suddenly slam on while somebody sort of crawled out of some little side road. But what would happen every now and again, and typically for most people it would happen about once a fortnight or so, you'd rock up to a junction and there'd be three other cars there already. And the one at the bottom would be waiting for the one on the right to move. That would be waiting for its one on the right to move, which is waiting for that one to move, which is waiting for the first one to move. And so you'd all sit there just looking at one another saying, who's going to break the law first? Because that was the only way that anyone would ever move. Okay. So deadlock occurs in sort of lots of different situations, and there are various techniques for detecting deadlock and avoiding deadlocks occurring. And the most common way of doing it is to have what's called a resource allocation graph. And this is drawn up by showing the threads or the processes that are running, also what these threads and processes are trying to control, and some sort of order of what they're trying to do. So you'd have a resource would be, a particular resource could be allocated to a process. That might be that the process is printing to the printer, in which case it's the printer would be allocated to that process. Or a request might be made that a process wants to write to floppy disk. It's made the request, but the floppy disk is busy, so it's a request that has to be has to wait for a little while. So a diagram like this would show that process P1 is currently using process R1 and wants to use resource R2, but it can't use resource R2 because resource R2 is currently in use by process P2. And how a deadlock could occur is, so this is fine that P1 can use R1, this is fine that P2 can use R2, and it's also okay that P1's blocked. It can't continue because it can't get R2. But that's okay, because P2 can carry on. But if P2 was to make a request for R1, then P2 would be blocked because R1 is in use, while P1 is blocked because R2 is in use. And that would form a cycle where you could go around in a circle between just following the arrows around. And that's the standard condition for, or the simplest way of checking if a deadlock can occur, when you go around in that sort of circle like that. And the actual conditions behind that type of graph working, mutual exclusion, a resource can only be allocated to one process or thread. Processes can hold resources while they're waiting for new ones, like P1 can hold R1 while it's waiting for R2. You can't push things out of the way, there's no preemption. So P1 cannot steal R2 from P2 because it's allocated to it. And there's a circle around in it. So if you've got the first three conditions and then you can draw a circle, a continuous arc, then a deadlock is likely to occur. One of the ways in which deadlock can occur in bank account type problems, what we're doing in the example last week was We had 10 bank accounts and were shuffling money from one bank account to another to make sure that you don't get shared memory corruption. What you can do is, in order to shift money between any two accounts, you can lock the whole lot. And that's what the synchronized method was doing. Synchronized transfer means that for transfer between two, all of the transfers get blocked except for the one that's taking place. That's a little bit of overkill, because you might say, well, we could do a transfer between 1 and 2. We could do a transfer between 9 and 10. And they can happen independently. So if this one's occurring, why do we have to block off the rest of them? So you might want to try and optimize it and say, well, let's just block the two that are involved in it. So a transfer method might say, all we need to do, if we're transferring from one account to another account, then we can synchronize on the from account, we can synchronize on the to account, and that just locks those two. And then you can transfer the money between those two, and all the others can carry on doing things as well. But that, although it works a lot of the time, doesn't always work. And it doesn't work in a case, for example, transferring 1 to 2, you lock those two. Transferring 2 to 3, you lock those two. That second one's going to be blocked if the first one's got a synchronized lock on 2. So if the first process is already locked 2, then the second process will have to wait. But then if you also throw in a 3 to 1, then you've got a circle occurring. Two is blocked because of process 1, 3 is blocked because of process 2, 1 is blocked because of process 3. So you've got a loop in there. Some of the ways of counteracting that, and there are lots of sort of simple standard techniques. What you do to break it is to knock out one of the conditions. And conditions such as the mutual exclusion, the hold and wait, preemption, circular wait. So if you can knock out any one of those conditions to make sure they can't occur, then your deadlocks don't occur either. So some mechanisms are things like knock out the mutual exclusion part. For example, make some resources unshareable, and that means that you can't hold them. This is a mechanism used, for example, quite often with things like the Unix print server. Under things like DOS, any process can get access to the printer and can hold that printer. But what's done under Unix is the printer is made only accessible from one printer service. So only one thing can ever deal with the printer directly. If anything else wants to talk to the printer, it has to go through this middleman. And so what happens is three processes might be requesting a print. They all send messages to this middle object, and that queues them in order and then sends them off to the printer. So because that middle process is the only thing that can talk directly to the printer, you've lost mutual exclusion and you can't deadlock on the printer. Hold and wait is the kind of situation with the bank account where you could lock one account and then try to lock the next one. If you forbid that from occurring, this first hold of a resource, then also you can avoid deadlocks. And one way of doing it is to make sure that you can't hold more than one at a time. This is not very practical. Okay. No preemption. If you break that, it means that you can sort of steal things from other things. Sometimes that results in lost data. Or the last choice, and this is the most common one, you avoid the circular wait by arranging things so that you can never get the cycles to occur. And one common way, for example, with the bank account is to put the bank accounts in order. So every bank account has some sort of number associated to it, the bank account ID. If you make sure that you lock in ascending order, then if you're always going up, you can't go background to make a cycle. So if you're doing a transfer, you first of all figure out which is the highest number account by just doing a simple comparison. And then you lock the highest one first, and then after that, you lock the lowest one. So if you're trying to do transfer from 1 to 2, then you firstly lock 2 and then lock 1. If you're doing from 2 to 3, you'd lock 3, lock 2. 1 to 3, you'd lock, or 3 to 1, you'd lock 3, lock 1. And that manages to avoid the cycle by always going down or always going up. Okay. This is a little bit more tricky, and you don't see this used quite so often, is you may get cycles occurring, but they may not quite occur at the same time. So you might have P1 is currently using R1, right at the end of its use, it will start using R2, but not for the whole time, just this little overlap period at the end. Whereas P2 might be using R2 and then give it up and use R1 maybe with a bit of overlap again. And even though there'd be a cycle occurring in this, because there's only a little bit of overlap, you can work your way around that sometimes. Won't go through the algorithms for that because they're pretty complicated. There's a thing called the Banker's algorithm which takes several pages and is pretty tricky. If you're interested, look in books on concurrency or books on operating systems. Okay. Right. Just as another example of using threads, if you want to list the directory and all the files in the directory and all the files down below that, the usual way of doing it would be to just have a single threaded solution. So if you wanted to list everything downwards, you might want to write the name of the current directory, loop through all the files in that directory. If it's an ordinary file, write its name. If it's a directory, then recursively call it to list files down there. So one way which would be done using single threading, you start off by looking at some directory. Say if your command line argument was the name of a directory, turn that into a file object, call list files from a particular directory. Then, okay, listing a directory would then consist of for each directory, print out your current directory. Get absolute path squashes all ...../... /.../... subdirectories and so on. Makes it a sort of canonical form for the file path. You can, if it's a directory, you can ask it for all of the files that are in that file, in that directory. And that returns you a list of files within a directory. If that list is null, it's just an ordinary file, it's not a directory. So just give up at that point. Otherwise, you could loop through all the files in that directory, get each file in turn. If it is a directory, or if it's not a directory, just print that file name. If it is a directory, recursively call list directory. Okay. So that's a sort of normal single-threaded solution which just recursively calls directories in that. So what it looks like, just threads, make it a bit bigger, view settings, font huge. Okay, so it doesn't do a huge amount. If we run it from the current directory, that directory doesn't have any subdirectories, So it just lists all of the files that are in that directory. If we made it the parent directory, this parent directory has got hundreds of files in it. So it lists all of the ones in the parent directory and all the ones in subdirectories down from there.
Okay.
An alternative to doing it, so this is your normal way of doing it. What we could do just for the hell of it, there's no particular advantage in doing this, but you could run it as a multi-threaded mechanism. That rather than doing each one sequentially, we could list each one concurrently. And you could do that by, whenever you find a new directory, create a new thread and sum the files in that new thread, or list the files in that new thread. That would mean changing the class so that it extends thread. We have, again, the takes the constructor, which takes the file name. But if it's a thread, then instead of just calling list files, we call the start method. So calling that would set up the creation of that thread. And when the thread runs, it calls the method run, or the Java virtual machine calls the run method. And then within the run method, you get the whatever you want to take place. Mostly that would be the same. So list directory prints the current file name, gets a list of the files. If it's a directory, then loops through that list of files in there. If it's not a directory, then just print that one out. Otherwise, create a new one of these objects, hand it the current file, and tell it to start the new thread. And that does pretty much the same. But what it does do is not so easy to see from this. If you try it in the labs, what you'll discover is that the order of these things comes out slightly different. The sequential order is just going to always produce the same results. But if we're just firing off new threads every time we discover a directory, then some of those threads could be swapped in and out, and the order is not quite so determinate as to what happens in there. Okay. One of the common things that you often do with directories is, how big is the directory in terms of all the files that are in there? If you wanted to find out how big the directory, list all the files and their sizes, then a variation on that might be to have a sum which recursively keeps track of the number of bytes within all those files. If it's a single-threaded mechanism, we can use a private variable. The constructor, main and the constructors pretty much do the same. The only difference is that down in if the file is not a directory, then increment the sum by the file's length. And then at the end of all of that, in that variable sum should be the size of those directories, or size of all the files in the subdirectories. What's it called? Sum files. So it's just printing them out as it goes along, and then eventually comes up with the sum is something 92 million or something like that bytes. Okay. If you want to change that into the multi-threaded version, quite a few things have to change. If you're doing multiple threads, you're dealing with multiple objects. So this private variable now has to be shared between lots of different objects. And the easiest way of doing that is to use a static variable. Static variable belongs to the class. In addition, wherever you do a change to that shared variable, it would have to be synchronized around that to make sure that the conflicts don't take place in accessing it. So multi-threaded sum would do, to start off with, you'd have a static sum, and also where the change to sum takes place is needs to be synchronized on some object. What that object is got to be shared between lots of different threads. So again, that synchronized object wouldn't be a private object, but is a static object, which is shared between all the threads. Okay. The other problem that occurs in this is, how do you know when it's finished? Because you're keeping on creating lots and lots of threads, sometime, and they're all running asynchronously, sometime it's going to finish, but you don't know quite so easily just when it's going to finish. If it's a recursion, you know when the recursion's finished because you just back out of the recursion. A while loop, you know it's finished because you hit the end of the while loop. But for the threads, you're not sure when they finished because there's no simple counter for them. There is a method within the thread class called ActiveCount, but what the documentation for that says, it's a guess. That it's too hard for the virtual machine to keep track of all the threads that are actually alive at any stage. So ActiveCount is just a rough guess as to how many threads are actually alive. So to get around that, every time you create a thread, you keep a count. You increment a count of threads. When a thread dies, you decrement the count. And when you're back down to just one thread, then you know you've finished. So we also put in a shared variable, shared static variable, thread count. All accesses to that are synchronized. And whenever you create a thread, increment the count. And when run finishes, you decrement the count. So the multi-threaded version is then quite a bit more complicated. We've now got three static objects, the sum, how many threads there are, the synchronizing object, new sum files thread does a start. Every time you're going through it, you... okay, so we need some synchronization in there. Okay. What this chunk here is doing within main is trying to spot the end of all the thread creation and destruction. So it calls on the very first top level thread to start and then goes into a loop to try and spot threads when the thread count drops to zero. So if the thread count drops to zero, everything is then finished and you can print out what the final sum is. And there's a synchronized dot wait in here. Every time there is a change to a thread state, a thread should signal that a change has occurred, and this will get woken up every now and again. When it is the last thread that's available, it will be the last one to be woken up, and it can then do that check on thread count. If the thread count isn't zero, it just goes back to sleep again. Okay. All right, what's happening in the rest of it? Not a great deal changes in here. We've already talked about that. Increment the thread count when you create a new thread. So just before new sum, before starting a new thread, increment the thread count. When a thread is finished, decrement the thread count. This is at the end of the run method, and tell every other thread that it's finished so that they can be woken up, and also so that the count check can be done. And that more complicated version, hopefully, will produce the same answer. Was it 92.9? Oops. Well, it's nearly right. Okay, I'll check that out. Okay. All right. what the sort of conclusion is, Java makes it relatively easy to do threads. There are some fairly simple methods to start things going, but thread programming can throw up lots of errors and can get fairly tricky. If you're trying to do complicated things, then it can be fairly hard to get things right.